Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Alan Adams. I'm an editor with the Business Newsletter Research Recommendations and Vice Chairman of the National Press Club Board of Governors. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table guests, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, September 22nd, Judith Martin, otherwise known as Ms. Manners, will talk about etiquette of the press. And on Thursday, September 23rd, Speaker of the House Tom Foley will discuss congressional reform. Other upcoming speakers include Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, John Dingell, Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Werner, Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and Chairman and CEO of Amgen, Gordon Binder. Audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask it as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our table guests, our head table guests, and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called from your right. Mickey Maynard, USA Today. Brian Grulli, Detroit News. William Nykirk, senior writer, Chicago Tribune, and Therese Palmer, assistant to Mr. Johnson. Reginald Stewart, assistant news editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Richard Ryan, Detroit News, and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Jane O'Donnell, freelance automotive columnist. David Everett, Detroit Free Press, Max Gates, Automotive News, Warren Brown, The Washington Post. A few years ago, our speaker, Elmer Johnson, wanted to be chairman of General Motors. Today, he'd like to ban automobiles from city streets, including, I presume, cars made by General Motors. That's not just sour grapes that he wasn't named GM chairman. Rather, it's a genuine belief that automobiles are a major cause of urban problems. He says that, among other things, cars cause congestion, smog, increase our dependence on foreign oil, and are a considerable contributor to urban flight. Mr. Johnson is a project director of a study on urban transportation that is being released today. The study was sponsored by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in cooperation with Aspen Institute. Cars and cities are on a collision course, and a new approach to public policy is urgently required, he wrote in a summary of the study. One approach, he suggests, is adding 75 cents a gallon tax on gasoline. Mr. Johnson is a partner in the Chicago law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, except for 5 years in the mid-1980s that he spent with General Motors. He has been with the law firm since 1956. Former GM chairman Roger Smith personally recruited Mr. Johnson to General Motors. Within 4 years, he was a vice president and a member of the board of directors. He also was thought to be a contender to succeed Smith as chairman. But he was a bit of an in-house maverick. He once told a reporter that GM had become a little fat, dumb, and happy. Some would have considered that an understatement. And he challenged Smith on building the Saturn Corporation, advising against it. Today, Saturn is one of America's best-selling automobiles. When it became apparent he wasn't going to be elected chairman, Mr. Johnson resigned from General Motors and returned to Kirkland & Ellis in 1988, 5 years after being hired. Among GM folks, Johnson may be best remembered for negotiating the buyout of Ross Perot. GM bought Perot's electronic data systems for $2.5 billion in 1984. 2 years later, GM paid Perot $750 million for his stock to get him out of the company. Mr. Johnson was born in Denver 61 years ago. He graduated from Yale University in 1954 and received his law degree from the University of Chicago. Besides the study on urban transportation, Mr. Johnson plans to talk today about the future of America's large corporations, or to put it another way, do they have a future? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club, Mr. Elmer Johnson.
Just remember, there's one thing I don't like about the press. They have access to way too much information. He said that I was going to speak on two subjects today, and I've been trying for the last 2 weeks to figure out how these two disparate subjects relate to each other. I feel very schizophrenic, and Ellen said, don't worry about that. The audience you'll be speaking to are very much of the same mind. I would like to say a few words about the urban transportation project before I launch into this other subject and answer your questions, which I'll be happy to do. This report is hot off the press. It was issued today, so you're the first folks to receive copies of it. I see a few of the participants in this project sitting here, and they have not seen the report until today. I'm very excited about it. I hope you read it and write about it. And I guess my two themes are not totally unrelated. As we all know now, Vice President Gore is trying to reinvent government, which is all about downsizing and simplicity and decentralization. Those words sound very familiar to me from my GM days. In both cases, we have these large bureaucratic cultures. I had responsibility at GM for public policy affairs and government relations and a wide variety of other things. And I was somewhat appalled by the dreadful similarity in approach of these two great big bureaucratic cultures, the adversarial approach to every matter, the short-term incremental reactive approach at the failure to take into account the excellent analytical work. It seemed that there was no luxury for strategic thinking, either in government or in industry. And that's really what we've tried to do with this report on urban transportation. To step back, I went to see Bill Riley and Sam Skinner at the time, and they both strongly urged that we undertake this project, and they helped launch it in December of 91. Now, when you think of the need to reinvent the large corporation and the need to reinvent government, I guess it should come as no surprise that something is terribly wrong with public policy as it relates to the automobile. And it's that that got us started on this project. We started thinking about the symptoms. Consider these facts. Over the last two decades, we have doubled the amount of vehicle travel in this country. I believe it's something like 98% of all surface travel by individuals is by motor vehicle today, 98%. We own twice as many autos. We drive them twice as far per capita, as is the case in any of the next 10 highest vehicle density countries in the world. We drive them much longer than we used to. The average age of a car today, I think it's something like 30% of all vehicles are 10 years of age or more. 20 years ago, that figure was 10%, not 30%. Older cars tend to be higher polluting, less efficient cars, so it is no wonder that we have found it very difficult to deal with these problems of air pollution and energy efficiency. We consume 40% more oil today than we did 20 years ago, despite the doubling in new car fuel efficiency. So we've done a wonderful job of regulating the new car, mandating technologies for it. We have not done a very good job of tending to the older cars or focusing on the driver and his or her habits. When you think about the city, and this project, as you will see from the report, does focus on the city. What have we done to the city? Well, when 98% of your travel is by automobile, you can imagine what happens to public transit. It's not very good. We've practically driven it out of existence in many cities. That means that a very sizable segment of the population is without basic mobility. Those are too old, too young, too poor, too disabled to drive, are left with public transit or what is left of it. In Detroit, for example, 25% of households are without a motor vehicle. Those that need jobs must go to the only place where they are, the suburbs today, but the public transit system is about as bad in Detroit as anywhere you can go to in the country. And so we have really deprived a very sizable segment of our population of a basic good, mobility, that severely constrains their opportunities for education, for jobs, and for just plain participation in the daily life of the city. Thanks again to our extensive use of the motor vehicle, we have developed every nook and cranny of vacant land around the edges of the city. We have exploited our zoning ordinances, our segregated school districts, to create this stratified metropolis of today. And of course, living out there, we need not worry nearly as much about the problems of the inner city. And because we don't worry about them much anymore in our residential enclaves and our isolated school districts, those problems continue to grow worse. Well, when you think about it, the nature of the automobile and the nature of the city are in a very uneasy truce, an uneasy tension. The essence of the city is concentrated cores of activity, intensity of activity, that take place in a relatively small core areas. Which today are several core areas, not one in the typical city. The car has tremendous space requirements that the city does not accommodate well in the core areas. The car is a wonderful instrument for taking a few people from anywhere to anywhere, but it is not well designed for transporting masses of people into a concentrated core of the city. This decentralizing force of the automobile has, in fact, transformed our cities over the last 20 years. We have a very different kind of city than we did. Joel Gouraud has written about the Edge City, but a lot of this that's happened has sapped these central core areas of their former energy and vitality. Well, I could go on with these symptoms, but suffice it to say that cities and cars are colliding due to a monstrous failure of public policy. This mix of public policy has had two key features. On one of them, you have to go back almost to the beginning of this country. We like mobility in this country. We like to subsidize mobility. It's been national policy from the beginning of time. You can't have too much mobility. And therefore, we subsidize all forms, including the private motor vehicle. John Meyer, one of our participants from Harvard, estimates that the typical well-off commuter, and remember, we subsidize mobility across all income classes. This has nothing to do with equity. Everybody gets subsidized no matter what your income is. The well-off commuter from the suburbs typically pays about 25% of the cost of his or her travel into the central district. The other 75% is paid for in ways that have nothing to do with you, the driver. Some may be paid by the employer in providing free parking for you, some in pollution that affects all kinds of other people, congestion that affects other people, and so on. the degradation of public transit is a result of congestion. So in order to understand how we got into this mess, our participants went back and looked at the past mistakes. Say, all right, you start with the fact that we like to subsidize mobility heavily and do in all sorts of ways, including just underpricing or not pricing the side effects of motor vehicle use. Well, we started to wake up in the late 60s. We said, we've got to do something about that. And we came up with a marvelous invention. We said, let's do it to the manufacturers. The people that drive the cars won't notice it as much. We'll get reelected much more easily. So let's do it to the manufacturers. We'll force them to install new technologies to reduce emissions, new technologies to make the car more crash-worthy, and ultimately, by the late 70s, new technologies to make the car more fuel efficient. Well, now, why didn't that work? Why did the symptoms I've described make it appear that we have made very little progress in the last 25 years, despite this monumental effort at new car technologies? Well, why do people keep their cars much longer? Why have we had this trebling in the relative age of old cars, the trebling of the population of old cars? People say, what's my incentive for buying a socially responsible new car? I have to pay 50% more in real terms to get that new car with all its fancy mandated technologies. And incidentally, there really is no effective inspection that's going to stop me from polluting the air in my old car. So the fact that 10% of the cars in the typical urban setting account for 50% of the pollution, and most of those are older cars, this person has no incentive in his or her private life to do anything about it. And then just one other thing. You say, gosh, you just subsidize, you make it so easy for me to drive my car. You don't charge me for driving into these very densely populated core areas, so why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I have the personal convenience? Well, that's the explanation of what went wrong, and it's 2 years ago that the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Aspen Institute said, why don't you put together a group that will look at these past mistakes, try to understand them, and try to come up with a much better way. I think it probably is the first time, certainly in the last 30 years, that anybody has taken a comprehensive look at all the social consequences of the motor vehicle in the urban setting and say, how do all these things relate to each other? There's a great deal of fragmentation in all of life, in academia, in government, in business, and too little time spent on trying to synthesize and come up with comprehensive strategies that take into account the interrelationships of all these different social consequences. So we did that, and we said we're going to have some near-term strategies for changing people's habits, price signals for one thing, first and foremost, that say to people, this is what it really costs you to drive. Now, if you still want to do it, after you have this congestion pricing, you can. If you want a cheaper way, you can park on the periphery of this Chicago Loop District and get on a very nice light rail system that will take you within a few blocks of your destination, and parking will be very cheap out there. But if you insist on driving to your own private employee-paid parking place, you can still do it at a price. By the way, we're going to get rid of the tax deductions, and the benefit of doing so will at least be taxable. Right now, parking in my employer's garage is tax-free to me, and it's a tax deduction to the employer. It's the only such item where an employee perk is tax-free to the recipient and tax-deductible to the employer. And so many of our strategies are these kinds of pricing strategies. They're not the only kind. A lot of people say, well, you can't change people's habits. You can never do that. But look what we did with civil rights. Look the progress we've made in terms of women in the workplace, more recently cigarette smoking in public places. It is possible to change people's habits through the combined force of law and education. And for us, using the law means mainly using market-based strategies to signal the economic truth. Our midterm strategies are aimed at the vehicle itself, the fuels, the infrastructure. Again, most of them are market-based strategies, but we would have strategies that make it more likely that we will see a much bigger mix of electrical vehicles in the urban setting. Gas-fueled vehicles, natural gas-fueled vehicles, are a big part of the answer, and I think we will see this particularly among fleet owners. Taxi cabs, Federal Expresses, the UPSs, and so on, where they can have their own refueling stations. It is probable that we will have 4 to 6 million of these natural gas vehicles, and I'd say a much larger number of electrical vehicles by the year 2005. Now, finally, our longest term strategies go to changing mobility structures and changing land use patterns in the city. That's way out, 20 years out, and you don't begin to even do any of those things. We've always talked about having a wonderful intermodal system of transportation with easy interface between the car and other forms of mobility. But you can't do that except in the right price environment. And so that's why each set of strategies builds on the nearer term and midterm strategies. So that by, say, 2020, we could hope for cities with wonderful intermodal systems, some of them planned around transit-oriented communities, pedestrian-oriented communities, mixed-use developments, so that we'd live in cities much, very much differently, and we'd have car-free zones that Ellen mentioned. Amsterdam has just voted that through. They will have a relatively car-free zone with marvelous forms of public transit to take its place. Parking on the periphery of that little core that represents 10% of the whole city. Stockholm is introducing congestion pricing next year or the next. All the legal actions have been taken for doing so. A very sophisticated form with electronic tags in your windows that get read automatically by overhead beacons. So there's a lot going on. Chris Macon, sitting here with the Aspen Institute, invited me to address the transportation group in Aspen. One thing I found is that I need not address all these recommendations to megacities. Little Aspen has terrible problems of congestion. I guess their leadoff speaker didn't show up, and they invited me in the midst of something else to step in and say what Aspen could do, and I thought, God, they could be the microcosm for much larger situations, and they can... They only have one way in and one way out of the city, so it would be easy to introduce congestion pricing and let the tourists pay through the nose and let the local repairmen get in for a much lower rate. So I think we're onto something out there. I might even hire myself out as a consultant, Chris, if you can arrange it. I don't mind at all spending time out there. So I'm very hopeful about the future. As you can see, this does not rely on the federal government to do it all. Most of the initiative will have to be seized by state and regional governments. They're on the local scene to deal with local problems. I think there'll be a lot of experimentation. I was over visiting this morning with some DOT officials who are very strongly in favor of this decentralized approach. It fits in very much with what Vice President Gore is up to. So I'm very hopeful, and I hope you will read it, and I hope we can muster the political will, which is what's been lacking, to do this. Nothing else has worked. We may actually have to resort to the thing that does work and muster the political will to get it across. Now, I promised to talk about that other subject. Do you want me to go say a few words about it? I did spend 5 years there, as Reginald said, and he said, tell us the inside view. What went wrong at General Motors and IBM and all these other large corporations? And are they going to find their way back? Well, naturally, when I left in 1988, I thought about this a lot. I was thinking about it a lot while I was there. And here's how I doped it out. And it is amazing the way the... I looked at the Fortune 100 the other day. Very few of them, when you look at their return on capital, their total return to stockholders, can justify their size. I could find about 10 where you could say, gee, there must be economies of large scale. These 10 companies do pretty well. They even have returns on capital that put them in the top 100. I would say the history, when I went to General Motors in 1983, I did have a talk with a very senior executive of one of the auto companies. I said, what's the most important thing going on in the auto industry? He said, Elmer, bigger is better. In 1990, we will only have 6 automotive companies in the world. The rest of them are going to go into the dustbin. There just is no substitute for global economies of scale. I was awestruck and went back to my office and thought about it, signed up for General Motors. 1996 companies. Well, I looked it up the other day. There are 160 automobile companies today. And, let's see, there are about 16 or 17 that have at least 1% of the market in the United States. That figure was about 4 companies because of Volkswagen. It got up to 4 25 years ago. So I found the world's gone just the opposite way of what I was told by the leadership of the auto industry. And so I said, why have things gone the other way? Why have economies of scale taken a nosedive over the last 15 years? I think one thing is just the advent of global markets, telecommunications, the computer. We do not have to reduce everything to one large corporation. There's a very, very excellent book written by a professor at Yale by the name of Oliver Williamson, who said, if economies of scale are so wonderful, if hierarchy is so wonderful, if we eliminate these costly transactions in such a marvelous way, why don't we just have one big corporation? We'll all work for it and save a lot of money. Well, I guess something happens to people. I guess you just don't get the best out of people. You build up some strange costs that you didn't foresee, the costs of the bureaucracy. And I'll get to that in a minute. Number two, we got into niche marketing. A little BMW could, in global markets, sell its car all over the world. Number three, I'd say flexible manufacturing reduced economies of scale. General Motors used to believe that when they got to the point of producing 1 million cars of identical kind, they could make big money. With flexible manufacturing, you can have a plant no longer that produces 500,000. The optimum size plant is about 200,000 a day. And besides, and more important, with flexible manufacturing methods, you can produce 40,000 distinct cars in that 200,000 car a year plant. So 5 very distinct models coming off favors the smaller operation. And then I'd say finally there's been a tremendous revolution, something akin to a moral revolution in the workplace. What we have learned from the Japanese is an amazing thing, that the human resources are a great untapped source of efficiency if you know how to tap them. And they came up with a method of production that the American car industry is all learning from and implementing now. And the same thing that's happening in government, decentralization, simplification, downsizing, is happening in all of industry. Now, these tremendous changes hit the auto industry at a time when they were trying to deal with all these the onslaught of federal regulation telling them how to make the car. That complicated things a little bit. But to make matters worse, what kind of culture had been built up over 40 years of peacetime prosperity, stability, where everything was predictable? After World War II, we could build on, we could conquer the world. Europe was trying to recover. Japan was trying to recover. There were times when GM got up to 55% of the market. The auto industry sold 7 out of 10 cars in the world or more. And yes, that quote that you mentioned about getting a little fat, dumb, and happy, I did say that. And I remember Roger coming into my office that day, didn't like that remark too much. And I showed him something from the New York Times from a year ago where one of our own directors, in fact, the senior-most director on the board, had said exactly the same thing. I said, Roger, I'm just quoting one of our own directors. Well, This culture was something that has had to change over the last few years, and I'm glad to see it has. It took 40 years to build it up. Cradle to grave security, years of service is the only criterion, total fragmentation of responsibility, centralizing everything in the search for global efficiencies. I could go into great detail on the facets of that culture. I could be describing General Electric or IBM or any of them. As I say, years of service becoming the only criterion, young, talented people saying, I don't see a lot of light at the end of the tunnel. And I'd say with the arrogance and all, a certain culture that we top management don't receive bad news well. Don't come in here with bad news. If GM's market share is slipping, it's a temporary aberration. Please. We've been on top for 40, 60 years. Don't come in with information like that and pretend it's something we ought to get concerned about. So when I got through doping it out, both the global external changes and the internal cultural problems that made us unable, ill-equipped to face those changes, I went off to talk to the chairman of a very, very large other company in another industry. And I said, am I wrong? Have I doped this out right? And he said, you've just described my company. And you're right, it is a 30 or 40 year culture problem. And we may have to skip a generation of management. My prescription at GM was basically that, just saying goodbye to about 100 of the top 500 people and bringing in about 25 people to replace those 100. And obviously that would stir up the middle 300, and there were 100 that were already darn good, and that was the beginning of my prescription. And it looks to me like GM and a number of other companies have certainly gotten the message and are doing all the right things now. It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant to come to work each day and say, what plant do I close today? Whom do I fire today? But until they get their cost structures under control, you don't really have the luxury of thinking big thoughts and all that. So they're going through a lot of pain. And I tried to come up with a public policy plan that that they ought to go for if they're rational. I think we all ought to share, not just the auto industry, but all of us ought to share in dealing with the problem of cities and cars. And we ought to give some of our attention not only to new cars, which is all we've done, but to give some attention to the people who drive them. Now, do you have any questions?
Mr. Johnson, we do have a few questions, I must say, on both the subject you talked about. But first, on your basic report, here are two questions. The automobile is perhaps the 20th century's symbol of American independence. Americans see their cars as a birthright. Many of your proposals would seem to go against that feeling. And then a lot of people take cars because they feel safer than they do riding public transportation. If you were to adopt these recommendations, wouldn't you trigger a huge need to make public transit free from crime and fear? Stop one subsidy and start another.
Yes, these are not easy problems. The answer to the first question is, as you'll see in the report, we recognize that this report is just the beginning of a vast social learning effort. It may take 10 years of consensus building, of education, of social learning, before you see widespread adoption of many of these policies. I just think that it's a matter of when, not whether, we get to these strategies. And the sooner we get on with it, the better. As far as making public transit safer, cars have gotten a little unsafer lately, as people have noticed who witness or read about carjackings. This is a very unsafe world. I think there are a lot of opportunities with the use of technology to make public transit a lot safer than it's ever been, and there are opportunities for small van public transit that are being explored in various areas. So I think that there are lots of technical possibilities for adding security to public transit. And even if you have to supplement that with more human resources to ensure security, it will be a far more efficient way to provide transit, and I would stress in an intermodal network.
If your recommendations are adopted, won't there be a shakeout in the auto industry beyond what's already occurred? What kind of policy is it that would kill downtown and the GM, Chrysler, or Ford? Humane?
Well, I did think about that a little bit. First of all, I told you that we focused on new cars to the exclusion of where most of the damage is coming from, old cars. In Japan, it's you seldom see a car more than 5 years of age. Now, maybe they've gone too far in accommodating the auto industry, but when you understand that 50% of the pollution is caused by 10% of the vehicles, I think we ought to do something about it. And I think we now know technology has provided an infrared gun that can instantly identify high-polluting cars on the road. You don't have to stop everybody at these inspection stations every 2 years. You don't have to have universal on-site inspection. You can identify these cars, the high polluters, and you can say, instead of what Colorado does, Colorado says, well, Frank Cicero, you've got a new Jeep, $800 personal property tax. Now, if you keep it 10 years, it'll be $80. We've got so many incentives to keep your old cars. What if Colorado did just the reverse and said it's $80 for your new car? And now, testing with this gun, we notice it's become a very high polluter. It's going to be $800 a year this year. He would say, gosh, maybe it's time for me to think about getting a new car. What I'm getting at is that I think there are a lot of things in this report that will be quite encouraging to the car industry. But much more important than all that, I would say that, yes, I do advocate a reduced role for the private motor vehicle in the urban setting. That reduced role, I think, will be dwarfed by what's going on in the world today. I mean, we've got all these countries of Eastern Europe, Russia, China. Today, as I recall, 69% of the world's population have about 6% of the world's vehicles. We have not begun the process of internationalizing the auto. And if we have a safe public policy environment, that can be tapped. And I think we're about to see the suppression of automobile demand in the formerly communist countries was pretty severe. There's a tremendous, as the market principle spreads to these countries, as people grow in prosperity, the demand for cars is going to be very bright. And I think it's incumbent, if I were running one of these car companies, I'd be thinking about where the real growth is. The United States is saturated with cars. It's a replacement car market, essentially, today. We have 200 million vehicles for 250 million men, women, and children. So I'm not worried at all about the health of the auto industry, and this is peanuts in the overall picture.
There was a question referring to replacement vehicles, would you comment on the electric car and its possible and its prospects for the future?
Well, we have one of the world's experts sitting right here. I ought to turn the podium over to Dan Sperling, who was our foremost participant, especially in this regard. He has a lot of other expertise as well. But Dan is the one that really encouraged me to give a very significant play in the report to the future of both the pure electric and the hybrid electric car. The hybrid electric, in many ways, is more intriguing to me. It couples a small gasoline engine or other chemical fuel-burning engine with the battery electric so that you don't have to worry about the battery losing its juice while you're out on the road. That's very important for a lot of families who don't have three different cars for three different purposes. So the hybrid electric is a very, very intriguing concept. The pure battery electric, as Dan Sperling would tell you, can be ideal in the city. How many people need a range of more than 100 miles for city driving before plugging it in again? And it doesn't have to become the car. Suppose it just becomes 10% of the solution in the city. That would be a major revolution and would solve an awful lot of problems. What we decided in our report is there is no one magic bullet. It's not going to be this pricing strategy. Certainly a fuel tax we put fairly low on our agenda. It would be wonderful we have it. We understand that we're not likely to get it soon. We put a lot more stress on what states and local areas can do. And incidentally, states and local environments can make it very attractive for electrical vehicles by according them special privileges, perhaps exemption from congestion pricing or special parking privileges. All kinds of things come to mind. So the electric vehicle, I think, has a bright future. And Dan on the technical side would tell you that those battery problems are going to be overcome, and the first generation will be like the first generation of VCRs. People that are a little wealthier will buy them. You may see them first in Aspen, but later on it's going to get better and better, and you're going to see an awful lot of them. So I'm very optimistic on that account.
There were a number of questions about your 75 cent a gallon gas tax, and I guess this one sums it up. If it takes $2 a pack to stop cigarette smoking, what size gas tax would it take to stop driving?
Well, you've got a good point. We said in the report, we don't really care whether the tax is to raise money or not for government. That's somebody else to decide. It would accomplish our purposes if that tax were revenue neutral. If you paid 75 cent gas tax, more than what you pay now, but you got an offsetting reduction in your income taxes, it would still accomplish our purposes of changing your habits at least slightly. How slightly? Well, the evidence shows that the basic benefit or effect would be that you would be a little more careful in choosing the kind of car you drive. You'd probably still want to drive just as many miles. It takes more than a fuel tax to change our devotion to the car as our major way of getting around. So it is part of the package, though. It would have clearly a very significant effect in getting people into electric vehicles and other kinds of smaller, more fuel-efficient cars.
We have some questions on a couple of names here, if you will. You knew Ross Perot during your time together at GM. How do you think he's doing now?
So you want me to end up in the courts for the rest of my life? I spent a little time in court with this man. I had a lot of fun, too. Ross really likes a good scrap. And I think he likes to be popular. I think he's one of the greatest Old Testament prophets I've seen in modern times. He likes to utter down his indictments on us lowly mortals from the mountaintop and tell us how badly we've screwed up. And I guess society needs a few people like that. I just don't think he's the one I want to elect to carry out any of the answers.
And here are two questions about your GM colleagues or former colleagues. How much can GM's problems today be blamed on Roger Smith, and is Jack Smith the man for the job?
Well, as I said in my remarks, I think the problem of GM, IBM, and the others are primarily a bureaucratic cultural problem that goes back 30 or 40 years. Roger certainly inherited that culture, and I think the 80s were a bad time for a lot of people. I think a lot of people got more greedy, they got more full of themselves, they thought they could conquer new worlds. Roger thought he could make acquisitions that would transform the nature of General Motors. So I would say he deserves part of the blame, but the real fundamental analysis goes much deeper than that. As to Jack Smith, I think very highly of Jack. I think General Motors is fortunate to have found the right person inside General Motors. They did skip a lot of people, as you saw, over the last year or two. And if I were on the board of General Motors now, I'd feel very good about the changes that had been made. I think it's a very tough assignment, and they're doing all the right things.
There were several questions about your views on NAFTA, one related to Ross Perot and NAFTA, but with Representative Gephardt next door announcing that he is opposed to NAFTA, well, they would like to know your views on the subject.
Well, my view is very simple. I'm in favor of NAFTA. I'm in favor of free trade wherever you get a chance to advance the cause of free trade. And this one, I think, is not only in our selfish interest, but it's also, as being a leading nation in the world, it has to do with helping other nations with their economies. I don't think we want to have such a place that the only way to get ahead is to immigrate into the United States. I think we have to help Mexico and Canada with their problems, but I think it's still in our own interest as well. And let me tell you, first and foremost, if we start doing this kind of thing, we'll really become non-competitive in world markets. At the very time we're into global markets, for us to start closing the door and protecting ourselves so that we don't have to come to work every day and worry about who's nipping at our heels would be the worst thing we could do to ourselves.
These questions refer to your suggestions about downsizing automobile production. And what do you do about the white-collar workers and the blue-collar workers and their jobs, and generally the impact on GNP and the consumption of automobiles?
GM what?
GNP, gross national product.
This is not a typical recession. This is a permanent restructuring of our economy, as so many people have said, and part of it is because of we build up these bureaucratic cultures that don't work very well. We have discovered from other folk modern production systems that require a lot less middle management. So there is no other choice if we want to be competitive in world markets. There's a lot of suffering, a lot of it because we didn't do our trimming year in, year out. And so it's all piled up and has been handed to, say, Jack Smith at General Motors to accomplish what should have been accomplished over the last 20 years in small bits and pieces. But I don't see any alternative to that amount of suffering. The alternative really is even worse, and that's bankruptcy, ultimately, if you don't do it.
What will the new United Auto Worker contracts do for the industry or against the industry?
I yet don't see what it's going to do for the auto industry. I think that the UAW very cleverly picked Ford because Ford is in the strongest financial condition, and they figured they could negotiate the strongest pact with Ford, and I'm very hopeful, not optimistic, but I hope that GM can negotiate some deviations from the Ford contract. As you know, the only new feature is that Ford can hire young incoming union people at less wages than the older folks. That favors Ford very much because Ford needs to grow. They cut back very severely in their workforce between 80 and 88, and their market share has been going up lately. So it's custom made for Ford and custom made against General Motors that is in no position to be hiring people right now. So the only good news in that union pact is one that has no application to GM. I'm hopeful that the union will, for the first time in history, be willing to negotiate other than on a pattern basis, but I am not optimistic.
These questions relate again to the kind of the fallout of your proposal. Many of the old cars are owned by people who can't afford new cars that adequately replace the old. How do you suggest dealing with equity issues and policies to remove old polluting cars from the road?
Yes, I didn't cover that. The report is strewn with the equity implications of each of these proposals and how to deal with them. But there are numerous ways in which people can be paid a bounty for their old high-polluting car if it can't be fixed, where it will still be in the national interest to pay that bounty that is a much lesser cost than all the alternative ways. So that is one of several ways. Of course, you can also use the tax system with special tax credits or deductions. But the equity issue certainly will have to be addressed.
Again, an impact question. Are you trying to drive downtown malls and businesses out of business? Why should anyone want to locate downtown if they have to pay more?
Well, we'll find out from Amsterdam. They've just embarked on a very bold, ambitious program. And I say in the report that car-free zones are not for everybody. It won't restore Detroit's downtown ghost-like atmosphere to a vital center again. There'd have to be a lot of things done before that. But if the city is already vital, take the Chicago Loop District, where we are considering a light rail circulator system that could later be combined with congestion pricing that at least reduces automobile traffic significantly. One thing I like about congestion pricing and creating so-called relatively car-free zones is there are all sorts of in-betweens, all sorts of experimentations, fine-tuning, mid-course correction. It's not laying down some heavy track and saying, my gosh, it's done, we're stuck with it for the next 20 years. Not at all. So I think one of the most persuasive things to me was the fine-tuning that can be done along the way.
This question is about the intelligent vehicle highway system. Opinions are mixed on the long-term value of IVHS. In your view, will the initiatives produce significant reductions in congestion and related problems, or are we spending money on a lot of cute laboratory research?
There are so many different facets to IVHS. For those of you who have not heard of it, it stands for Intelligent Vehicle Highway Systems Technologies. And a lot gets brought under that umbrella. One of the simplest and yet most effective that often gets brought under that umbrella is electronic toll collection. If you drive on the North Dallas Freeway or anywhere in the Oklahoma Turnpike system, you do not have to stop if you have the electronic tag in your windshield. You go speeding through at 70 miles an hour. And it does have, in urban interstate areas, a significant beneficial effect on improving the carrying capacity of the road. That's fairly elementary stuff. It's sophisticated to you and me, but in the IVHS world, it's about as elementary as you can get. Other things on the horizon are collision avoidance systems so that people can be warned of impending collision. The argument is that we spend way too much of our money on crashworthiness and not enough attention has been focused on avoiding the collision in the first place. These new technologies show a lot of promise for improving collision avoidance. And of course, the ultimate most far-out thing of IVHS, pictured, if you will, cars getting on a highway, and you push the button on your dashboard to go automatic, and you are now 3 feet in back of the car in front of you. Your speed is regulated, nothing you can do about it. And because of this wonderful IVH system, you have just tripled the vehicle throughput per mile of the freeways. Well, you know, I'm willing to listen. I think if anything went wrong with it, it's pretty scary. And then there's one other thing I worry about a little bit. When they get off to go into city centers, we now have 3 times the number of cars. What do we do with them when they get off on the side streets? So, you know, I think it's a ways off. But nevertheless, there's enough good stuff going on that I think it's worth keeping up our investment in it and let the experts prove themselves one step at a time.
In your observations, you sound very certain that bigger is not better. How then do you view the mega mergers of recent years? Would you endorse mergers of Viacom Paramount, for example?
Well, you're getting a little out of my field now. I guess I was talking mainly about these monolithic manufacturing corporations. If there is something going on in telecommunications that requires a new strategic concept, it may have not so much to do with size, but bringing together related fields of expertise that will need to be brought together in the future, but I have no idea whether that could be done at much smaller size levels than is the case in the example you cite. I really don't. I think the main argument there is not just to get bigger and achieve economies of scale. It's a basic strategic concept.
On the matter of scale, would you favor a return to more aggressive enforcement of antitrust laws?
Not as long as we have competition. I think global competition has... I always favor antitrust laws for, in terms of price fixing and collusion among sellers and so on. But in terms of preventing mergers and so on, I think it's pretty stupid and has been proven pretty stupid over the years. I hope we don't see a reemergence of that phenomenon.
We have several questions, briefly, if you will, on corporate restructuring. They all simply want to know what can corporations do, or what has been done to corporations in terms of corporate restructuring. And they face hardship not just from foreign competition and government regulation, but what else?
Well, you know, when I got out of General Motors, one thing that bothered me a lot was boards of directors. I thought they were far too passive. I felt that there were only two ways out of the mess that I described earlier to you. One was the leverage buyout, and we certainly saw a lot of those in the 80s, where corporations bought in their stock and loaded themselves up with debt and got rid of lots of people and breached a lot of implicit contracts, and then they had to go public for more equity money later on. Some of them didn't make it. I thought there was another way that ought to be explored, and that was board governance reform. I thought the directors ought to start to develop a fiduciary conscience. I thought that they ought to reform their board practices. And I lectured about it. I wrote about it. I guess I spent a major part of my time for 3 years. I helped get a new rule through the SEC that makes boards of directors explain to the stockholders why they're paying these people what they're paying them. And you'd be surprised how it makes directors stop and pause and say, gosh, you mean we have to actually report to stockholders? And the idea is, they're the ones that elected you, you know. And, well, it's, you know, never thought we had to communicate with stockholders. So I think it's sort of a nice thing to raise people's sensitivity, and boards have been stepping up to the plate, as you know, in the last year. And there have been a number of us that have been preaching this gospel, and I think it's having its effect.
We have time for one last question, but first I would like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for appearing at the Press Club.
Thank you very much.
And a mug for,
well, terrific.
For your morning cup of coffee.
Excellent. Thank you.
Before we go on to our last question, I'd like to say again that audio and videotapes of today's luncheon are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. All proceeds of the sale of tapes benefits the National Press Club Library.
Thought he was going to say they all go to benefit the Urban Transportation Project.
That's next year. The last question. Do you still think Saturn wasn't such a good idea?
Well, I made it very clear when I spoke up. I said, you know, Roger's always encouraged me to speak up at board meetings. And I said, I don't have the slightest doubt that it will be a very good car. My opposition is based on one set of arguments, and that is it was conceived in 1984. Since then, we've lost 10 points of market share. Our overcapacity is extraordinary today. It wasn't 5 years ago, 4 years ago. Number three, the industry, the whole industry worldwide is awash in overcapacity. Why are we building a new plant? If we're going to do it, I don't mind doing it, but why are we spending $3 billion maybe instead of $1 billion to do it? Maybe if we spent $1 billion like Chrysler did for the Neon, we could get a return on capital. We didn't have to get so full of ourselves and and have 40 governors vying for plant location. And I think we could have had a very good return. Are we at the point of having any return yet? Is GM? I say we. My guess is it has not achieved a positive return after all these years. I would guess that besides the $3 billion of initial investment, that another $1.5 billion could be added to that in operating losses. $4.5 billion, what kind of return does it take? So my objection was not whether it be a good car or even a great car. It was how you do it, and how do you do it in such a way to get at least a decent return on capital.
We do have another couple of questions. One is perhaps addressed to me, and I don't have an answer. Is there any relationship between the problems Mr. Johnson has identified and his choice of ties for this occasion?
Glad you asked that question. You know, after I got 27 or 30 scholars together and a like number of people from industry and government, each with a different sliver of knowledge and expertise, I saw this tie, and I saw all the different parts of the jigsaw puzzle, and I said, will I ever, ever be able to put this all together? And for most of the 2 years, I didn't think I could or we could, but I really feel good about the report, and next time I'll wear a tie where they're all fitted together and the puzzles come together. So thanks very much for being here today, and thanks for taking a look at the report.